When I started to think about this month and this theme, immediately I thought of the song we sang earlier, "'Tis a Gift." This is a song I have come to appreciate, but I definitely didn't start there. For a long time, whenever I heard, "'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free, 'tis a gift to come down where we ought to be," I thought, really? Is it a gift? Is it really? But I just wasn't convinced. And maybe some of you share my skepticism. Maybe you, too, aren't sure. 'Tis a gift to be simple. 'Tis a gift to come down where we ought to be. Maybe you aren't sure that coming down is a worthy goal. Or maybe intellectually you appreciate the idea of simplicity, but then you go to practice it and something in you resists, sabotages your efforts. One of my favorite pieces of wisdom that my mentors have offered me is the saying, "Don't resist the resistance." Mostly they say it as advice about congregational health, so that when there are voices of resistance, occasionally there might be, to a vision of ministry or initiative or whatever we might be doing, the wisest course, they would say, is not to become, in turn, the resistor to those voices, but instead try to understand them. Listen. Resisting the resistance usually only increases the resistance, makes it dig in deeper, creating division where you actually were seeking wholeness. Don't resist the resistance can also be applied to individuals, particularly in terms of spiritual practices. In meditation, for example, you might find yourself resisting the practice, the quiet, the breath work, what have you. Rather than resisting the resistance, the helpful practice is to explore that resistance itself, to remain curious about what inner tensions or judgments are going on. Then the resistance simply becomes a part of the practice so that you're better able to fully participate in the moment as it is. All this is to say is that this sermon is what happened when I stopped resisting my resistance to simplicity. Not just about the song, but about the concept more generally, and instead started exploring it. In her book, Your Money or Your Life, Vicki Rubin tells the story of two novice Zen monks who are arguing about whose master was more evolved. They were novices. One of the novices claimed that his teacher was so powerful that he could stand on the bank of one river and write his name on the sand of the other shore. "That's nothing," the second one said. "When my master is hungry, he eats. And when he is tired, he sleeps." And with that, the second one won the debate. We laugh, but really, how many of us actually sleep whenever we are tired? Or eat when and only when we are hungry? I mean, something in us does resist this simple logic. We read all sorts of books about health and happiness, research, and attempt many different formulas. But really, there is this simple formula that would probably go a long ways in our health and happiness. Sleep when you're tired, eat when you're hungry. But we resist and go looking for a more complicated answer. Liberation ethicist Miguel de la Torre offers one possible explanation for our resistance. In his book, Doing Ethics from the Margins, de la Torre questions the value that traditional religion has placed on simplicity, arguing that the values of selflessness and humility were established, particularly by those with a certain kind of privilege. As he says, those who formulated these dominant ethical precepts may have wrestled with the prideful sin of self-centeredness, but the marginalized among us have instead suffered from a lack of self-identity. The traditional religious values of simplicity or selflessness, he says, have been used as tools of oppression for women, the poor, and people of color. Rather than lifting up continued simplicity or bending and bowing, De La Torre says a more liberating message would be to encourage a stronger selfhood, dignity, and self-worth. And so perhaps our resistance comes from an acknowledgement that simplicity is not always a good thing. Definitely not a good thing for everyone, particularly not those who have not chosen it, but rather have had it thrust upon them by way of poverty or racism or other marginalizing forces. There is, after all, a big difference between voluntary simplicity and involuntary poverty. As John Yema writes in a recent article in the Christian Science Monitor, people in subsistence culture rarely see simplicity as desirable. They hunger for more food, cleaner water, better schools, greater access to electricity, healthcare, transportation. Won't affluence and choice make their lives more complicated? Yes, please. He goes on to remind us of one of our own spiritual forebears, Transcendentalist Henry David Thoreau, who we often point to as a model of simplicity. Yet as Yema acknowledges, Thoreau's simplicity relied on an underlying complexity. He could always stroll into town for a warm meal from mom and a chat with his pals. Whereas we often lift up the saying, live simply so that others may simply live, Yema is pointing out the ways that individual simplicity, acts of individual simplicity, sometimes depend upon a whole network of other people's willingness to a greater deal of responsibility and complexity. For a somewhat extreme example, I offer the reality show Island Hunters. It's a show. Have you heard of it? Island Hunters. It's like House Hunters that you may be more familiar with, but they're shopping for an island that they can buy for themselves. Inevitably, as the prospective buyers share about their intent, they acknowledge their desire to simplify, to escape the hustle and bustle of life. They want to get away from it all and spend every day on their beach that they own. It sounds awesome, right? Except that think of all the people, all of us, who are not on our own island, who have to live non-simple lives to make their simple life possible. Now, I'd call all of this stuff I've been talking about so far mostly my intellectual resistance. But there is something less analytical, more intuitive, that is an even bigger source of my resistance to simplicity, and maybe you can relate. It's the resistance that shows up when I try to put into practice in real life some new habits of simplicity. It's the resistance that acknowledges this is not easy. Simplicity, as the saying goes, is not simple. For one thing, complexity, busyness, acquisition of stuff and ideas, these things come by way of effort. And we like efforting. It is self-rewarding. We work hard, we feel good. We do things, we feel good. We buy stuff, we feel good. We feel our worth. But simplifying requires we live into the principle that we say we affirm, our inherent worth. It has nothing to do with how much stuff we have, how much work or to-dos we get done, how much we know, how much we help or care for others, or even how many hours of volunteering we put in. Simplicity requires a deep trust of our inherent worth, worth that is there regardless of any of these other things. And secondly, there is a certain habit to having and doing a lot, a hard habit to change. That habit of moving quickly, that habit of feeling like you can't possibly fit everything in, do everything. Changing these sorts of habits can mean upending years of ways of being. changing the energy in you and the way you interact with your friends, families, coworkers. Simplifying requires new habits, difficult habits like saying no and meaning it. Saying no even to things that might be fun to do or to have, even saying no to people that you might love and cherish. It means acknowledging your limits and knowing that the only way to say yes to your most important yes in life is to say no to almost everything else. Which brings me back to the story that Lenny shared from Paulo Coelho's book, The Alchemist. The mini tale that we heard focuses on the question of the secret of happiness, but set in the context of the book as a whole, which it is, the book is about finding your life's purpose. I hear this story as a lesson on how to achieve your individual happiness, and more as an instruction on how to live in a way that is aligned with your purpose and place in the greater web of life. There's probably all kinds of things we might wonder about this story. If you haven't read The Alchemist, it's sort of a series of these kinds of tales where just over and over he sort of puts these little ideas in front of you and you're left pondering, what might that mean? Well, in this case, what I'm thinking about from this story is the drops of oil. Specifically, that it's just two drops. Just two drops that this boy needs to protect. Think of that. I mean, we're familiar. Just imagine, two little drops. It's not like when I used to wait tables and somebody would order a martini and I'd have to figure out how to get the order delivered without spilling half of it. That was impossible. This is just a couple drops. And I think that's important. Because it turns out that even a few things are difficult to keep in your teaspoon as you attempt to travel through this life. We might think of that spoon as the space of your heart, the hours in the day, the attention or contemplation of your brain. Think of how much stuff we're trying to fit in the teaspoon. Everything you add, every little drop requires more attention to protect it. More attention on the spoon, in turn, means less attention on the bigger picture, the marvels of the world, what we might call the view all around. The view in our lives, in the daily sense, all the beauty, everything, everywhere. But also the view in the bigger picture, who we are meant to be and become, how we fit in this greater web, in all its beauty and terror, our impact, our interdependence. I was thinking about all this last week when I was away, this story and my resistance to simplicity and the two drops of oil, all of it, when my family took a day-long trip to the Exploratorium in San Francisco. If you haven't been there, it's sort of like our Discovery Museum, but on steroids. We spent the whole day there, and we still didn't see everything. My kids were quickly going from one thing to another, and often I'd be trailing behind, trying to read and learn and absorb every exhibit. It was all really fascinating. One display invited you to watch a video where there were two teams, one wearing all black and the other wearing all white. They each had a ball that they were bouncing and passing back and forth, and then you're instructed to watch the video and count how many bounces the white team made throughout the whole video. At the end of the video, it says, did you get 12 bounces? And I thought, yes, I did. 12, I felt good. And then it said, did you see something strange happen in the middle of the video? No, I hadn't. What was it? The instruction said, watch again, but this time, don't try to count. I thought of the boy and the second time through the kingdom. And I watched again. This time I saw that in the middle of the video, a person in a gorilla suit walked out in the middle of the game, danced around, made a big fuss. It was totally obvious. And the first time, so focused on the counting task, I saw none of it. I was too focused on protecting my drops. Like most things, it seems to me that we need here a middle way. Simplicity need not be about doing away with everything, saying no to everything, or romanticizing having fewer options or fewer possessions, even about living in some sort of prescribed way. Instead, it can mean listening for and understanding what is your way, the way of your own life's purpose, your life's calling, if you will. What will be your drops of oil? What tasks, commitments, stuff, people, what goes in your spoon? Those things that you'll protect, even though it will require concentration and distract you from the bigger picture. Which doesn't mean you don't care about the rest of the stuff that's not in your spoon. It just means they aren't yours to carry. I think of Sister Simone's caution about progressives that we think we have to do it all. And when we can't do it all, we won't do anything. She says, that's wrong. The world just depends on you doing your part. Simply doing your part. For whatever you put in your spoon, if you actually plan to hold on to it, the holding on will keep you that much more away from seeing and experiencing all the beauty. So this month, maybe even start with this week or today, my invitation to you and to myself is to consider one or two things that you don't need in your spoon and to let them go. Whatever comes to mind right now, that's probably right. So just go with that. As you do, consider first the question, what is right about trying to keep that thing in my spoon? Because that question will surface your competing commitment, the commitment that keeps you protecting this thing that easily it came to mind as something you don't need to be protecting. Remember, don't resist the resistance. Just be curious. What's right about holding on to this thing that I probably should let go? Acknowledge it. It's all part of our practice. Maybe tell somebody about what you're letting go. Ask for help. Remember, I said it wasn't easy. You might even try praying about it. And if you struggle with prayer, I suggest this one. Help. Say it every day. Don't worry too much about whom you're addressing in the prayer. This is one of those things that the saying that prayer doesn't change things, prayer changes people, and people change things. It applies here. We're trying to create new brain patterns, new life patterns. So repetition is good. Help! Singing it could even be helpful, you know? Why do we think that there's so many music in ads? It sinks in a different place. Along the way, I invite us to tell each other how it's going, how we're doing on letting go of all the oil that isn't ours, that's taking up room in our spoon, keeping us from looking up and paying attention to all this beauty. Little by little, perhaps we will find the middle way that will allow us to see and experience all of this life, even while carrying our worthiest commitments and relationships, protecting those. This, I think we'd agree, would be a real gift. May it be so, and amen.